meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com. It's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
And good evening, everyone. You are listening to the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Of course, our website, like the man says, is ScaredMonkeysRadio.com. And whether you're picking this up on satellite, on the internet, on the podcast, or wherever, it's always nice to have you. P.J. Weeb was murdered on January 5th, 2003. And after six trials, it has become a very well-known case in Canada, and particularly the province of Manitoba. If you want to talk about a case that brings the whole question of the system into order, this is one case. And this is a Canadian case, but it's a North American issue. I thought what I'd do tonight is bring on TJ's dad, Floyd Weeb, first to talk about the case, talk about some groups that he's working with and his thoughts about the system, and in particular the death of his son. And then a little later on, we'll bring on Mike McIntyre. He's the host of the Crime and Punishment radio show to continue on with this. And then after that, our old buddy Dog the Bounty Hunter has been in trouble lately, and I have his attorney, Brooke Hart, with me to talk about that. But let's start out with Floyd Weeb. Hi, Floyd. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dana. Thank you for asking me.
It's always difficult when you have a parent of a loved one who has been taken prematurely from this earth on with you to talk about cases like this, but it always amazes me, and Mike McIntyre and I have talked about this, and I've talked about this with many other guests, of the strength that people like yourselves are able to go through. Your boy TJ was taken on the 5th of January 2003, six trials, a whole big question as far as the system goes. There's a couple of websites right now, folks, I want you to go to. One of them is www.tjsgift.com. That's TJS Gift. And that's all one word, .com. And another one is www.mova.ca. That's the Manitoba Organization of Victim Advocates that Mr. Weeb is a member of. Let's start, first of all, Floyd. Tell us a little bit about your son, and then we'll get into the whole aspect of the case.
Okay. Well, my son was 20 years old. You know, we have a pretty normal family. My wife and I have been married 32 years. We have, you know, we had three kids. We have two other kids that are twins, and they were 18 at the time. TJ was 20. He was in school. He was in getting his second diploma in welding at a regional school here. And he, somewhere along the road, got involved with drugs, and in particular crystal meth, and also got involved in selling of crystal meth and cocaine and other things. And, you know, we had him in Addictions Foundation Manitoba, which is like a place to help kids, obviously, with addictions, and just a couple months before. And, of course, he denied he had any problem. And you know, it was really crazy because I took him in there, and they also said, you know, there's nothing wrong. Your son does not have an addiction problem. Have a good life. And with that, it seemed that his drug use escalated, and probably the sale too, because I think that gave him sort of a more power, and you know, gave him a license to do it more. At least that's what I'm surmising. And on January 5th, four people basically got together, and they decided that they would take my son's life, and they did, and it was a brutal, brutal murder. Basically, four people planned it. They sat around a kitchen table. They planned all kinds of methods and watched movies with Val Kilmer in it, and decided they would copy that, and they did. And basically, two of them eventually took my son out. They injected him with Drano in the neck. They strangled him. They made cell phone calls to the mastermind of this murder, who was a 17-year-old, and TJ wasn't dying fast enough. And this is all evidence. This is not me making it.
Right.
Actually, this is right from court.
Right.
And the kid just basically said to them, you don't, you know, effing kill him. I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to kill your son. And I've got needles for you as well as TJ, sort of thing. So they took it upon themselves, and they, you know, and we don't really know the whole sequence of events, but he was beaten. He was strangled. He was injected in the neck with Drano. He was stomped on. He was stabbed in the neck. And he was thrown into a farmer's field, you know, in Canada, 40 below weather, on January the 5th. And they left him there to die.
The brutality is hair-raising.
It is.
The website, again, it's tjsgif.com. Goes into more detail, and we want to spend some time as far as the case itself goes. But you brought up an important part to one of the co-accused, the 17-year-old, and something that I've spoken about on this program. Again, Mike McIntyre and I have covered the Youth Criminal Justice Act, which is the legislation, body of legislation in Canada that deals with children between the ages of 12 and 17. When you're 18, you become an adult here. Let's talk about that for a second, Floyd. The Youth Criminal Justice Act and the failings thereof when it comes to the case and your son.
Well, I you know what, Dan, I can't really say that the YCJA had anything to do with the failing of the case. Because the rules of evidence are the same. It's only the sentencing that changes.
Right.
And since the youth was not convicted, really the YCJA did not come into effect. It would have come into effect had he been convicted, but he was acquitted. And basically he was acquitted because the three others refused to testify against him. And they all, of course, got charged, further charges, but I mean... It means nothing. It means 3 months, 6 months added to your sentence or concurrent. And basically, he got away with scot-free. But you can't say that was a YCJA at all, because that only kicks in after conviction.
I guess I should clarify, when it comes to the Youth Criminal Justice Act, and there are many, many examples of sentencing. When it comes to maximum sentences in the Act, the rehabilitative part of the Act rather than the consequences and punishment part of the Act. And again, yeah, I understand that it doesn't really affect or come into play as far as your son goes, but I wanted to bring it into a broader spectrum. When we talk about a 17-year-old,
oh, yeah,
or a 15 or a 16-year-old that's been through the system several times, but their case is basically a rehabilitative case, a slap on the wrist, and they see no consequence for their crime and are able to get into a horrific case like your son's, is that a failing of the Youth Criminal Justice Act?
Well, I guess my comment would be, and I'm going to bring it back into more of a global aspect, what would have happened had he been convicted, he would have received, even as an adult, because he could be sentenced as an adult, because murder is a case that even with the YCJ, he could be sentenced as an adult, and he would get a life imprisonment. However, the maximum he could ever spend in jail is 10 years
right,
for first-degree murder, which is ludicrous when you consider the other three who were like 18, 19, and 20, although none of them were convicted with first-degree murder at the end of the day. Nobody ever is, it seems, in Canada. And they did get lengthier sentences. But I mean, he's walking the streets. And you know what the real bad thing is, Dana? He spent 32 months in pretrial custody in the youth center. 32 months. And I can tell you stories. There's a Morgan Trudeau who was murdered 6 months after my son, and Joel Geddes, the guy that murdered him, was convicted eventually of a plea bargain of manslaughter. Dana, he spent 15 months in jail.
Yeah.
And he was guilty.
Yeah.
Now, how does this explain the criminal justice system when a guilty person is 15 months in jail and a not guilty person, such as the one that killed my son, spends 32 months?
Yeah. No, and that's my point.
It is.
It is a it's a failing in the system. And right now, thank heavens, some of the government, the conservative government, is taking a look at the Youth Criminal Justice Act and other parts of the system. But from the perspective of a, not only as an advocate, Floyd, but as a parent of a victim, and families are victims too, the system failed, in my opinion. Here, it took too long. As you say, the consequences of refusing to testify, you know, obstructing justice, call it whatever you like, you know, 3 months, 6 months, stuff like that. It's become a joke where there are no consequences for committing crimes here in Canada, and that's something that needs to be looked at.
Did they cause the acquittal of that young offender? They caused the acquittal by refusing to testify. And to cause somebody to go free, Dana, and get a 3 month sentence for that, does anybody listening to your show even understand, comprehend that?
Right.
And these guys all gave video statements prior and then just refused to testify against them.
The system is a quagmire, in my opinion, right now. The system is a system of plea bargains, quick fixes. Let's get through what we can get through, and let's try and make it not cost as much as we don't want it to cost, as we come to put a dollar value on justice. Has that become a problem for victims, victims' families, where they get a distrust of the system, and all of a sudden something may happen, and they're afraid to come forward and testify? They're afraid to come forward because they know that they become part of the system, they become the accused, and the accused gets all the rights where the victim gets nothing.
Well, I mean, I remember the very first time I talked to one of the Crown attorneys. They basically said, "We're not your lawyers. You or me, I don't have any representation. Even though my son is the one that has been brutally murdered, and he's never coming home, and I have absolutely no representation. Dana, I don't even get a preferred seat in the courtroom. If you beat me to the courtroom, you get the seat before I do. I have no rights to talk to anything at all, and it's shameful that you have no opinion, no, there's nothing to validate you as being a victim until the end of the trial, when a judge may or may not let you read a victim impact statement." And that's very poignant. May or may not. It's up to that person. So, I mean, I could go on and on and on. When you spend as much time in a courtroom as my family did, and like you said, six trials, I don't know anybody who's gone through six trials. And hours and hours of listening to the same thing and listening to the games that the lawyers play. And just to, and I'll tell you one thing, it's got nothing to do with the truth.
Right.
It's got absolutely nothing to do with the truth. There was not any truth. We listened to all those trials, and you know what? Each trial was different. The facts are the same. The murder's the same. My son is still dead.
Yeah.
But each jury or each judge did not hear it because so many things in this particular case was ruled out. Different judge, now they rule out something else.
Right.
It's absolutely amazing. Like, if you went through one trial, you really wouldn't know. But when you go through six, your eyes, I mean, and you even get mixed up because you're listening to one trial and you go, oh my gosh, well, what about this? And it's not said. So the jury doesn't convict or they acquit or whatever because it's got nothing to do with the truth. It's all got to do strictly with rules of evidence. That's tough to take as a father sitting in a courtroom.
It has to be incredibly discouraging. And one thing, and you mentioned it early, we talked about your son and his involvement with drugs, his addiction. When you go to the webpage, there's a quote there where your son talks about how hard he worked to keep his addiction from you, from your family. And,
absolutely.
And you work so hard as a family to protect your loved ones. You always think that it won't be me, and and this is my son, and look at all the stuff that he's done. Let's get into a little bit about the system and helping kids with these addictions. I've heard case after case where children with addictions go to a counselor, for example. The very first words out of the counselor's mouths are, "You don't have to be here if you don't want to."
That's right.
And the kid looks at them and says, "Okay," and walks
out of here
and leaves.
Yep.
That's a huge failing of the system. Let's talk about how we protect our kids from drugs, and when they do get involved, how can we help them further?
Well, and on that light, when TJ died, because, and I got to go back just a tad, I mean, TJ was missing for 5 weeks before we found him.
Right.
So we were looking for him and looking for him and looking for him, and as it got time delayed, we knew that. And, of course, got turned into homicide detectives, and then they arrested the murderers. The murderers led them to my son. And finally, we had a couple of arrests. And, you know, he was killed January 5th. We didn't have a funeral until February 22nd. I mean, think of that.
Right.
January 5th, February 22nd. It's hell. But we knew we would have that there would be a large funeral. TJ was popular. My wife and I are quite well known. And, there was over 1,000 people at his funeral, Dana. And we knew that we had to do something out of this, and we formed the TJ's Gift Foundation. Not at that point. We had an educational awareness fund. But long story short, now we've formed a TJ's Gift Foundation, and we've raised over $62,000 already. And one gala last year, we raised $54,000. We're having another one next May in Winnipeg. And you know what? We had the mayor, we had the premier, we had MPs from Ottawa. I mean, Rob Nicholson, the federal justice minister, was going to fly in, but he was called back to Ottawa at the last second. Stephen Harper asked my wife and I to meet with him about a month ago when he announced the $64 million in drug awareness and education. And so we are making a difference. And what we've established is a foundation to help kids in school teach each other about the perils of drugs. Because you know what? Having a cop or a drug guy come in or a gal come in from, you know, it's 40 years old and relating to kids that are in grade 7 isn't going to cut it.
Exactly.
And they don't listen. And we're not saying that we have the whole be-all and end-all at all, but we have one more prong in the fork against it. And we really believe, my wife and I, that kids get other kids into drugs, and we feel that kids can keep kids away from drugs. So that's why we're raising the money, and it's just starting to kick in now. And oh my gosh, Dana, I've got a Facebook site. I talk to kids every day of my life, teenagers and 20-year-olds and 21-year-olds, kids coming up from my past that I coached in baseball, and it's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
These kids are involved in drugs, and they're trying to get off, and TJ's death helped a lot of them get off, and some of them are still going, and it's heart-wrenching, and we're going to dedicate the rest of our lives. I wish I knew now. I wish I knew then what I know now. Unfortunately, I had to have a horrible tragedy, but we're moving on.
When you go to the website, again, TJ's Gift.com, there's a story behind the logo there that you designed, and I think that's a moving story. Share it with my listeners, please.
Well, I designed it. It's like a stylized T and a J, and without them seeing it, it's kind of like if you look at a T, and it's kind of bent, and there's two parts to a person. And I had one, like a full, like a darker blue, which is the more prominent side of my son. And then I had a little smaller part of him, not quite half, and it's a little bit lower, so it's just a little bit hidden from public view. I've colored it a little bit less, more of a shade of gray. And I describe it, in effect, that was the part that was hidden, that wasn't the part that people saw. That was the part that TJ was hiding, but it was very, it wasn't a small part of him at the end of his life. It was his involvement, his selling, his using, and I really felt that the logo had to describe what we were and who he was, and that wasn't easy because, you know, you're putting your son's name on a very tough thing to say that he was selling drugs, to say that he was a drug addict, and to announce that to the world.
Right.
Like, I'm shaking right now as I'm talking to you because I didn't want to put his face or his name on it, but, you know, we just felt we had to. And he's looking down at me now, and I know that he's behind us because I know that he realizes how important it is what we're doing. So we're just going to carry on as good as we can.
It is so important, and your bravery is so out there, but you're doing this for your son, and you're doing this for others, and you know that that he would have probably done the same thing if he could, because that whole addiction thing is such a stranglehold on someone that it takes them and they're not able to do what they want. And I want to ask you, because we're down to about the last few minutes here, your words for a parent who's got that suspicion that maybe their child may be on a drug or doing drugs or addicted to drugs, something's wrong, but they're so afraid to do anything, they don't know what to do, they're stuck, they're lost for answers.
Well, I would say get in their face, stay in their face, but you got to be their friend as well.
Right.
Don't just be a parent and yelling and screaming and tell them how bad it is, but get in his face, show the or his or her face, and just stay there, and just stay there, and just stay there, and get help. It's going to be a tough road. It's going to be a tough road. This is not easy for any parent or any kid. Crystal meth especially is absolutely horrifying. And I just say to parents, don't ever, ever, ever give up, that they'll come around. And we were going to hope TJ wasn't coming around. We knew he would. But stay in their face, Dana. Don't let it down, and whatever you do, don't kick them out of the house. You got to work with those kids, and you got to keep them by you and love them and show them how much that they mean to you, and they'll come around.
The media, are we doing enough? Are we educating enough? Because that's so important in this.
You know what? Your next guest, Mike McIntyre in particular, he's done so much for victims of crime. And I know myself, and you can ask Mike this later on, I don't know, but I think he's learned a lot from our family and from us because we were so public. We were public from the beginning, and I've worked with the media, and I have not been... We were hurt for the media at the very, very beginning, but you know what? I learned to work with them, and they have helped us unbelievably. And when we went back to the media several years later to go with our Drug Awareness Foundation, oh man, they were there for us. So yeah, they're good people, a lot of them.
The government's helping. They're sitting down and they're working with victims advocates and talking to John Q. Public and everyone. What can the government do more?
In particular, okay, do you mean with drugs or do you mean with victims?
Everything.
Well, with victims, governments can do a lot more. And I don't mean that victims should run the courtroom. I don't mean that at all. But I will tell you this, and in Manitoba it's getting better, but we're one of the better areas in Canada. In most areas in Canada, Dana, it's terrible how victims are treated. And what I say to government, if there's anybody of them listening, listen to victims, and I'm not saying let the victims run the courtroom, that's not what I'm about, but the victims' rights is information. We demand information. We need to know everything about how our son or daughter died. We need to know what happened, when, where, why. We need to know all the stuff that's going on in the background. Don't hide from us, because that kills us worse again and again and again. And governments, you know what? I've been working with Manitoba government for 4 years. And just today, we've received a fantastic letter. They're going to give victims the MOVA brochure. They've never done that before because they were afraid, and now they're giving it to them, and they're helping us, and they're seeing that we're becoming a help to them, too, because to get a parent through the court system, oh, man, I can't even begin to tell you, Dana, how hard it is to sit there day to day, and you need that support from government. And we're not even asking for money. We're not asking for anything. We're just asking for information. Tell us about what's going on.
Well, TJ's watching, and he's proud of his old man and everyone that's working with him, I'm sure. And you, sir, have an open invitation on my program anytime.
Thank you.
And we'll stay in touch.
Okay.
Take care, my friend.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. The websites are tjsgift.com, tjsgift.com, and www.mova.com. Check those websites out. They are moving. They bring it home directly to you. This is, Manitoba, Canada. And you can hear in that gentleman's voice what he's gone through, what his family's gone through. And just, again, another example of a parent who is coming forward and helping and teaching others from their loss. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be back in just a minute with Mike McIntyre to talk more about this and other things. All right, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Mike McIntyre is with me. He's a justice reporter with the Winnipeg Free Press. Of course, you can hear his Crime and Punishment radio show on the Chorus Radio Network or go to his webpage at mikeoncrime.com. Mike, how are you?
I'm great, Dana. How are you?
Good. Nice to have you on the show again. As you know, we just had Floyd Weeb on talking about his son, a tragic case. TJ was murdered, of course, you know, on the 5th of January, 2003. Six trials, lots of publicity. It's a case about the system in Canada, I guess, and I know you followed this up quite a bit, and I'm curious on your comments.
Well, yeah, this was a murder, I think, that really got the public's attention for a couple of reasons. Obviously, it was a brutal killing, the circumstances surrounding it, the fact that we learned the young man had essentially been lured out of the city and left to die. But I think what really captured the public's attention on this one is the fact that these were kids from middle-class families, from the suburbs, kids of some means. This was not a case of maybe the stereotype that a lot of people think of when they think of violence and drugs. These kids were not fitting that stereotype, and I think a case like this really hammers home to people that drugs really do affect everybody, from all income levels, all parts of every city. I mean, no matter where you go, drugs are an issue, and this case really drove that home, I think.
You know, there's proponents and opponents, and you and I have both done stories on this, on the war on drugs, so to speak, from the Canadian perspective. Of course, for the longest time with the Liberal government in power, we were talking about legalizing marijuana and the Youth Criminal Justice Act and the whole story about consequences fitting the crime. And now we see a case, or talk about a case, albeit a few years old, where the system is been questioned as far as drugs, as far as consequences. Talk about that a little bit, as far as the, my North American audience, as far as, is Canada doing enough on the war on drugs? And are we, is our system failing and other countries looking at us with an eyebrow raised?
Well, I think when we see drug dealers getting caught and getting sentencing, that we are seeing sentences, in fact, getting increasingly longer here in Canada, which is a rarity. There aren't a lot of crimes out there that you could say that the sentences are going up, but drug trafficking, drug dealing certainly seems to be one of them. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that judges in Canada realize the blight of drugs, the fact that drugs in probably almost every crime out there, drugs are playing some kind of factor, either direct or indirect. I think, though, this case, specifically the Weeb case, the killing of T.J. Weeb, certainly exposed some flaws in the Youth Criminal Justice Act because, of course, as Floyd mentioned, you had five accused here. You had four adults. They were all convicted. They were all sentenced. You had a youth, though, who was the alleged ringleader, the one who the Crown alleged dreamed up this entire murder plot and got all these accused to do his bidding. He walked free, and he was ultimately acquitted. And I think it's a case like that that certainly leads people to question the merits of the Youth Criminal Justice Act in Canada.
You were a rehabilitative state, and you can look at that either way. I guess maybe I've been in the system too long and I'm too hard-nosed, but that failing, some people will say the failing of the Youth Criminal Justice Act and the rehabilitative part of it, the sentencing part of it, and other, you know, we could do a whole show just on that Youth Criminal Justice Act, makes you wonder, and we don't hear a lot about it. We did initially from the Conservative government, but we haven't heard much lately, and maybe it's because of their minority status, but does there need to be a long, hard look at this act again? And, you know, if we didn't do it right with the Young Offenders Act, then the Youth Criminal Justice Act, what's going to be next?
Yeah, there certainly is a need to look at it, and I'm happy to say it is being done. The Conservative government has made it crystal clear they're not satisfied with certain provisions in the Youth Criminal Justice Act either, and I think there's a recognition on their part that there are some serious flaws here. They've seen the headlines, they've read the cases, and certainly they've felt the anger from the public, and so they are promising to not only review it, but to change it. Now, what scope that takes, I guess, remains to be seen, but they are vowing to not stop tinkering with it either. This is not a one-time thing. They said they will make changes very quickly. There will also be a full-scale review of the act scheduled for 2008. And I think the Youth Criminal Justice Act, as it stands today, is on the endangered species list, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike McIntyre is with me. One of the organizations that Floyd Weeb is with is the Manitoba Organization of Victim Advocates. You and I both know when we interview victims of crime, family members of victims of crime, parents, we see the strength and the determination of these people. You wonder how they do it, first of all. Let's talk about that in your experience as a crime reporter, talk show host, and in particular this case. How do these people do it and then go to work with organizations like I just described?
Well, they're very strong people, and I think some of the strongest and bravest people that I've ever met in the course of my career are victims, either survivors themselves or family members of those who have been lost as a result of criminal activity. I think how they do it is in large part because of the strength of each other. You know, there is certainly strength in numbers, and I think this is one of the beauties that we've seen. I mean, it's sad that these sorts of groups have to exist, but it's wonderful that they do exist for when these kinds of cases happen, because there is a network out there. And we see this happen all the time, specifically in Winnipeg, if we want to talk MOVA, of a family, a young person is killed, a family is grieving. Well, a group like MOVA reaches out to them in their time of need. And I think that's of some comfort, because you're talking about people that have been down that same path. They know what it's like. They know what lies ahead. And to have that support network out there is a truly wonderful thing. And I'm glad that groups like this exist. As I say, in a perfect world, they wouldn't have to exist. That's not reality. And at least there is support out there for victims led by very strong people like Floyd Weeb.
Is the government doing enough? We see these organizations like MOVA and others across North America working, trying to do what they can. Of course, it's the almighty dollar that plays into a lot of this with the system. Enough police on the streets, the the crime fight, if you could take it that way. Can the government do more, or is it time that the people stand up like they're doing and try to get things back on the right track?
The government can definitely do more, and in many ways they have failed victims of crime repeatedly by not involving them enough in the process, and this has become a, unfortunately, a very tired thing to see cases where victims are pretty much shut out of the process. They're not told of plea bargains being made. They're not told of the reasons for decisions being made. I mean, I've seen far too many examples of cases where they're not even told about court dates or, yeah, or things that are happening along the way, bail hearings. Victims seem to be an afterthought in far too many cases, and I think it's because of groups like this that's not going to stand for much longer, because you've got strong victims, victims who are willing to stand up, to speak out, and that's what we need. Sort of quietly hiding in the shadows is obviously not going to affect change, but to come out swinging, and we've seen a lot of families that do that, is a very effective way not only to change the kinds of lines of communication that exist between, say, justice officials and family members in terms of what's happening in their case, but I think to open up the dialogue, as they have, about the kinds of sentences being handed down and the fitness of the law as it stands. And I think that, in large part, is due to these very strong victims' voices that we hear loud and clear.
There are many elections going on now across North America. Of course, the presidential election is heating up in the States. The talk of a federal election here in Canada. My jurisdiction is right in the middle of a provincial election. And crime has become a hot political topic. Again, one party saying we'll put more police on the street. The other party saying we've already done it. And that becomes to be an argument, a political issue. And the people sit back and wonder, what is this all about? A lot of municipalities are trying to run police services like businesses, trying to make money from them. But when it comes down to it, the job, the oath that we swear to protect and serve and to fight crime without being flippant about that isn't being done. How political is this? And are politicians using this to buy votes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, justice is certainly a hot-button topic and one that I think is used and abused for a variety of reasons by people looking to score points with the public. And I'm all for politicians scoring points with the public if it means they're actually doing something productive, something positive. I mean, we'd like the public to be happy, because a happy public probably means a safe public, and that's good. But certainly, it is very political, and you know, you'd hate to see the safety of others, the lives of others, get sort of tossed around like a football. But we've seen that happening, just as we've seen specific cases that have become lightning rods for criticism, where some politicians try and score points by jumping on board, you know, the whatever it is that happened in that specific case and calling into question. But I think we need to, as I say, have that dialogue, have that discussion, because things as they stand today do not work. Crime is still happening far too often. Innocent people are being hurt far too often. And I think the general consensus out there is the kinds of sentences being handed down to criminals are far too light, far too lenient. And so, you know, I think it's always going to come down to the almighty dollar. There's always going to be a struggle as to, you know, how much is enough and what can be afforded. I just hope that at the end of the day that public safety isn't compromised at the expense of saving a few bucks.
Yeah, that's true. Floyd Wiebe and I talked about his experiences in the court system, and that comes back to stories that you've covered, and so have I. When you have people go through the court system and they see the court system either fail them or take so long or make the victim look like the accused, and the confidence in the court system becomes in question. And then you wonder about crimes that aren't reported, witnesses that don't want to come forward because of the system. What can we do, or what should be done with this system to try and make it more pro-victim, more satisfactory towards victims, or is it the best we've got right now?
Well, I think the Weeb case is a good example of where we can clearly point at one major issue and say, here's an area that should be improved. I mentioned earlier, as did Floyd, that the alleged mastermind of his son's killing, the young offender, went free. Well, that was due in large part to the fact that several of the co-accused, the ones who had already been convicted, the adults, refused to testify when they were called by the Crown to do so. They, I guess, did not want to give up anyone, and I guess there's sort of a code out there. There is honor among thieves, if you will. The consequences, though, for their silence were almost non-existent. These were men who had already been sentenced, obviously, for their role in the killing, but they were given 6 months for their silence, and that is hardly sufficient. There has to be a message that the justice system is not a toy. You cannot play with it. You don't decide whether or not you feel like testifying or feel like telling the truth. There should be no choice.
Yeah.
And yet these people made a mockery of the system, and we've seen other cases like that, specifically when they involve gang activity and organized crime, where there's this, as I say, this code where they try and protect each other, and it makes for very difficult prosecutions. But I think we need to see some real tougher penalties in cases where people refuse to testify. Let's hammer home the message then that if you're going to completely derail a prosecution, there's going to be a heavy price to pay for you.
Absolutely. Mike McIntyre is here from the Crime and Punishment Radio Show and MikeOnCrime.com. What do you got planned for this Sunday?
This Sunday, we are going to be doing one of our very popular features on the show where we get the Chief Provincial Court Judge from Manitoba on to answer listener questions. I'm always amazed at the fact, number one, that a judge is willing to sort of do this, because mm-hmm. it's pretty rare in Canada, as you know, Dana, to have a judge willing to sort of just answer cold questions from the audience. But that's what Chief Judge Wyant of the Manitoba Provincial Court does. So I'm sure there will be plenty of interesting questions in store for him again on Sunday.
Yeah, sounds like a good time. You know, with the states and all the judges and prosecutors that end up on TV and with their own shows, and then the complete paradox up here where you can barely get one to talk. That's a feat for you to get the judge to come on. Mike McIntyre, it's always a pleasure, sir.
Thanks, Dana. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We'll be right back here on the Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. If you've been following the news, you'll see that my friend Dwayne Dog Chapman has, I'm going to use this term, has become a target of some of the tabloid press. He has said some things that he has regretted, that he has apologized for, but now he's become fodder for some of these schlock media outlets like the National Enquirer. These celebrities have to be careful. They're under attack. They're being recorded. This was a private conversation that should have never been released, in my opinion. I thought I'd bring on Brooke Hart, Dog's lawyer, to talk about it. Hi, Brooke.
How are you doing, Dana?
I'm doing good. It seems like there's never a dull moment for you guys. How is Dwayne and Beth doing?
Well, they're holding up pretty well. There's a lot of focus on them right now because of Dwayne's unfortunate and inappropriate remarks, but I guess that's to be expected.
Well, we all say things that we don't mean in the heat of a conversation, in this case a private conversation, and we'll get into that in just a minute. It got the tables turned on him. In this case, here we have a celebrity, and I'm sure Dwayne is to the point where he's used to being attacked somewhat, but this is personal, this was private, and this is not Dog Chapman. He's apologized. Your thoughts on this and what's next?
Well, my thoughts are that Dwayne is not a racist. I've known him for 7 years. He made some very unfortunate and inappropriate remarks to his son, with whom he had issues because the son was violating the rules of his parole. And Duane believed that the son was doing this with the assistance of the son's girlfriend. And Duane used words that I've never heard him use in 7 years, and I know that he's committed to never using again, and he's very remorseful.
I talked to Duane Chapman here in September. We stood face to face and talked, and he and I both come from the old school, so to speak. And when we're talking in private, sometimes we use terms that, like you say, we would never use in public. All of a sudden, a tabloid magazine gets a copy of this tape. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the son recorded, or with the assistance of someone else, recorded the conversation where Duane, in a moment of real loss of self-control and upset, yelled at his son and ordered the son not to see the girlfriend anymore, and used disparaging terms against the girlfriend, who Duane has actually never met. And Duane has apologized nationally for that, and he apologizes to Tucker, his son, and to the girlfriend, Monique Shinnery, and hope that he will be forgiven. He's also committed himself never to use the inappropriate term beginning with N again.
Doc Chapman is a class act, and to come forward like he has just reiterates the quality person that he is. But I'm going to ask you a question, and maybe you can comment.
Well, he's a quality person who made a very, very significant
mistake.
Error in his reference to persons of color, and he recognizes that, and he apologizes for it.
How careful do celebrities have to be when it comes to conversations? Because we've seen several cases now where they're being recorded, and these so-called magazines are buying them to smear the people involved.
Well, given the technology, I think those who are in the public eye, in the media, who are celebrities, so to speak, have to be extremely careful, have to watch every word that they say. In this case, Duane was angry because he understood that the girlfriend and Tucker were going to try to record idle conversation inside the bail bonds office, where Duane might be caught making a reference to something that was politically incorrect or just wrong, and then using the information to enrich themselves. That was Duane's concern. And what he learned was, not only does he need to change his language and never use that word again, but he needs to be careful that those who are close to him will, for purposes of enriching themselves, try to make recordings of what he says and foul his world.
Yeah, absolutely. Last time I had you on the show, and just before I let you go this time, we were talking about the Mexican case. Can you give us an update there?
Well, the update is that both sides have submitted their pleadings to the court, and the court is considering the matter. As you know, in July, the Mexican trial court dismissed the charges based on the running of the statute of limitations. Mexico has taken an appeal. We've moved to dismiss the extradition proceedings in the United States because there's no basis on which to proceed with extradition if there's no outstanding or live warrant in Mexico. And our U.S. District Court in Hawaii has that matter under consideration.
Please send my best to Duane and Beth. I'm on their side. This is something that should have never happened and hopefully will never happen again. Thank you, Brooke.
Well, thank you very much, Dana.
Appreciate it,
Bye-bye.
Sir. Bye-bye. That's Brooke Hart, attorney for Duane Dog Chapman. We'll be right back. And we are back, and that's the show for tonight. I remind you to check out our webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com for information on upcoming shows, podcasts of past shows, and of course my daily commentary. Thanks to all my guests this evening, and we'll see you real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.